Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello and welcome to this FedSoc Forum webinar call. Today, December 10th, 2025, we're delighted to host a Courthouse Steps oral argument program on National Republican Senatorial Committee, NRSC, versus the Federal Election Commission, FEC, which was argued yesterday before the court. My name is Kayla Kleist, and I'm Deputy Director of Practice Groups here at the Federal Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's program, as the Federal Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. Now, in the interest of time, I will keep my introduction of our guest today brief, certainly more brief than his career would deserve. So I highly recommend that if you're interested, you check out his impressive full bio at fedsoc.org. Today, we are fortunate to have with us Brett Nolan, who is a senior attorney at the Institute for Free Speech, a public interest law firm that works to defend the First Amendment rights of those engaged with political speech and advocacy across the country. Before joining the Institute, Mr. Nolan served as the Principal Deputy Solicitor General of Kentucky, where he represented the Commonwealth in a wide variety of high-stakes litigation at every level of state and federal court. Prior to that, Mr. Nolan served as Deputy General Counsel to the former governor of Kentucky, where he advised the governor and other executive branch officials on legal and public policy issues and represented them in litigation. And I'll leave it there. This program runs slightly differently from some of our standard FedSoc forums, so I'll have a brief introduction, which we've just gone through, leave it over to Mr. Nolan for a summary of the case and oral argument, and then we'll go into a time of extended questions. On that note, if you have questions throughout the program, please do submit them via the question and answer feature, likely found at the bottom of your Zoom screen, so they'll be accessible when we get to that portion of today's webinar. I'll ask that all questions submitted there, A, pertain to this discussion, and B, end with a question mark. With that, I'll hand it over. Mr. Nolan, the floor is yours.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me, and thank you to everyone who is attending this. We have an interesting case to talk about today and an argument that I think was even more interesting than I thought it was going to be. I'll start with giving a background. So we're talking about NRSC, the FEC, and I'll go through a little bit about what the case is about and how we got to the Supreme Court, because the procedure of how we got to the Supreme Court sheds a little bit of light on some of the argument that happened yesterday. So this is a case that was brought challenging the federal limits on political parties engaging in coordinated expenditures with their candidates. So when parties spend money to help support and elect their candidates, they can, you know, spend money independently without communicating with the party, with their candidates, or they can coordinate those expenses. And unlike outside groups like super PACs, parties are allowed to coordinate with their candidates to some degree without that counting as a contribution, where you run into the federal contribution limits pretty quickly. But there are limits on how much parties can coordinate with their candidates. And so this is a case that challenges those limits under the First Amendment, argues that they're unconstitutional because they don't do anything really to prevent quid pro quo corruption or the appearance of quid pro quo corruption, which is the only justification that the government can rely on in order to limit or restrict political speech like this. So the parties in this case, the National Republican Senatorial Committee, as well as a few candidates. One of those candidates that brought this case is Vice President Vance. He was a senator when this case first got filed. He's now the vice president, and that affects a little bit of some of the arguments that we heard yesterday. They bring this case, and then they use a statutory procedure to have the question of the constitutionality of this law certified from the district court to the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals sitting en banc. And so this goes straight to the Sixth Circuit before there's a resolution at the district court. And the en banc Sixth Circuit addresses the constitutionality of the coordinated party limits. The biggest obstacle at the Sixth Circuit for the plaintiffs is that 25 years ago, the Supreme Court, in a case called Colorado II, already addressed a version of this statute and upheld the limits on party coordinated spending. And so the plaintiffs in the Sixth Circuit are arguing that various changes in the law, both the statute that's at issue, but also the legal doctrine that governs these kinds of claims, that changes since that decision have made it so that Colorado 2 no longer binds even the lower courts. And so the court should apply the more recent First Amendment decisions and find that the law is unconstitutional. Alternatively, the plaintiffs told the Sixth Circuit, well, we might have to go to the Supreme Court and ask them to overrule it. So the en banc Sixth Circuit upholds the law. All but one judge, I believe, on the court found that Colorado 2 was still binding. It was an overwhelming majority of the Court of Appeals judges said that they're bound by Colorado 2. You need to go to the Supreme Court. There was a split in the Sixth Circuit with some concurring opinions about where some of the opinions were, yes, we're bound, but we think that this law is probably unconstitutional. There were some concurring opinions that this law is perfectly constitutional, even though we're bound by Colorado 2, and it doesn't matter. The parties go to the Supreme Court, they file the cert petition, and then in the meantime, there's an election, the White House changes hands, and so the plaintiff, then Senator Vance, becomes Vice President Vance, and before the, it comes time for the Department of Justice to file their response to the cert petition, you have, new people in charge, and they, the Department of Justice files a response to the cert petition, agreeing that the law is unconstitutional, telling the Supreme Court to grant cert, and that if the court does, they're going to argue in favor of the petitioners. When that happens, you have at the Supreme Court, the Democratic Party moves to intervene. This is again before this court, I believe, had granted cert. They, ask the court to allow them to intervene to defend the law on the merits. As the Democratic Party, they believe the law is good and constitutional, and so they want to come in and intervene. The Supreme Court lets them intervene, grants cert, and then also appoints an amicus to defend the judgment below, which is a common practice when the Supreme Court grants cert in a case in which the Department of Justice is not defending a judgment in their favor below. And so you sort of go into briefing on the merits and getting ready for this argument, and you have four different groups of attorneys, in this case, two on each side. And so we had four. The argument yesterday, we had the petitioners, we had the Department of Justice arguing for the law, and then we had the court-appointed amicus and the DNC arguing, arguing for the law and the petitioners obviously against. So going into this argument, I think if you were to ask me what your prediction is, to me, it feels almost like a no-brainer. You have a court that's very conservative, especially on these kinds of campaign finance issues in the First Amendment. They granted cert in this case, where one of the questions is very clearly, however you look at this case, it's either the court is going to being asked to overrule Colorado 2 or say that Colorado 2 doesn't apply anymore. The petitioners are coming to the court and saying, your case from 25 years ago shouldn't apply. The grant cert, it looks like you probably have a majority of the court that wants to get rid of this law. It also sort of fits the mold of what we think of as the Chief Justice's. It seems like he can kind of prefer incremental decisions. This is, a case where you could cut back on some campaign finance regulation, strengthen the First Amendment, and do so with an issue that's kind of narrow. It affects political parties. It's, rather than saying contribution limits are unconstitutional, this is an incremental sort of strengthening of the First Amendment. So you see cert granted, it seems likely that that's where the court's going. So we had the argument yesterday. It goes over 2 hours long, which surprised me a little bit because, again, it's an interesting issue, but it is a little bit more obscure. It's not a real flashy First Amendment case, but you have four lawyers arguing. I think that you know, I still think that after hearing the argument, you know, it looks like the court to me is probably going to hold that this law is unconstitutional. I have no idea what that decision would say if my prediction's right. But I think the way I'd like to sort of go about this today is start with what I think were three themes of the argument that I kind of came away with. And the first theme was a discussion about whether or not this case really is as narrow as it seems, or is this sort of what the amicus counsel called a bait and switch? So to frame the petitioner's argument at first, the petitioners have brought, and they've been sort of really focused on how narrow and almost easy this case is from their point of view. What the petitioner said and what you heard yesterday during the argument is that this case is easy. It was basically already decided in McCutcheon, and we just haven't gotten there yet. And all you have to do is apply McCutcheon, and you've resolved this case. So McCutcheon was a case from several years ago where the Supreme Court invalidated aggregate contribution limits that prevented you from, if you donate to so many candidates and committees, there was an aggregate cap you could donate to. And the argument was that the government is worried that these what the aggregate limits do is they prevent you from donating to a bunch of different committees that then can donate to each other and sort of pool resources and you evade individual contribution limits. The Supreme Court invalidated those laws in McCutcheon, and the petitioner's argument here is this is just McCutcheon. This is the same thing. And I guess I should have maybe explained in my summary sort of the primary argument about why this law is unconstitutional and what the government or what the defense of the law, that response is. So I mentioned at the outset, the only permissible reason that the government can regulate or restrict political speech like contributions and expenditures is to prevent quid pro quo corruption or its appearance. And so contribution limits, what you're worried about is a large contribution is used as a quid pro quo. And so you limit, the theory is that you limit the amount you can contribute and you limit that from, you prevent that from happening. When it comes to limiting how parties coordinate with their candidates, or actually maybe a better way to explain this is that if you think about an outside group, an organization that might want to coordinate its spending with a candidate, that starts to look like, and the court has said that's very similar to a contribution. So you can't give the candidate, if you're an advocacy organization, you can't give the candidate $1 million, but you might go to the candidate and say, I want to spend $1 million. What kind of ad should I run? Or do you have, you know, a particular issue you think I should focus on? And then at that point, you have essentially done the same thing. And so the risk of quid pro quo is still there. And so that justifies treating coordination as contributions. Now, because you have that risk of corruption or the perception of corruption. Now, that argument really doesn't fit when you talk about political parties. And this is something that isn't really contested by even the people who support the law, which is that nobody thinks that a political party, when it spends money to support its candidate, is trying to corrupt its own candidate, that it's trying to bribe or engage in some sort of quid pro quo. And so there's not really a risk when a political party is coordinating its spending with its candidates that you're going to have that kind of corruption. Political parties exist for the purpose of supporting their candidates. If you ask someone on the street, hey, what do you think? It seems pretty corrupt that the Republican Party is spending a lot of money in coordination with President Trump. I think most people would look at you kind of funny. And so the defenders of the law, they don't make that argument. What they make is they call it sort of a conduit theory or an anti-circumvention theory, which is we have to limit coordination with parties because otherwise a donor who wants to make a large contribution for some sort of quid pro quo to avoid the individual contribution limits, they're going to give to the party and they're going to say to the candidate, hey, I'm going to give this money to the party, and the party is going to know to use it in your campaign. And now I want you to vote this way on a bill or you know, give me this this political favor. And so it's the defense of this law is this anti-circumvention theory. So it is a similar anti-circumvention theory that you saw in McCutcheon when you had the limit on aggregate contributions. And so the petitioners with this case just they repeatedly point to McCutcheon. And it's a good argument because McCutcheon says a lot of things that's very favorable to them. One of those things, is that once you hand money to a third party, yeah, you might think that they're going to use it for the candidate. They can do whatever they want. They have their own interests. And so it's really unlikely that you're going to have these elaborate bribery schemes where you're giving money to different people who are going to then send it to others or use it in certain ways. And that there's no evidence that this kind of thing happens. And that becomes a big part of this, the petitioner's argument here. Now, I said that, you know, the first theme that kind of stuck out to me is like, is this really a narrow, what the justices, I think, are really struggling with yesterday, some of them at least, is this a narrow case or is this some kind of bait and switch? And the reason that you see that is that the... You know, in McCutcheon, for example, one of the things that the court says is we don't need these aggregate limits. There are other things that protect from quid pro quo or, you know, the appearance of. And one of those things is that parties are limited in how much they can coordinate. So even if you could give a lot of money to the parties and you don't have these aggregate limits, the parties are limited in how much they can give. There are other things as well. Earmarking rules limit this. Disclosure rules limit this. So there are different things that all contribute toward limiting this. And one of those was the party coordination limits. And so you have amicus counsel, you know, yesterday in the argument, it's the first thing that he leads with. This is a bait and switch. They said in McCutcheon that the party coordination limits are what make this law, the aggregate limits, unnecessary. And now they're here saying that the party coordination limits are unnecessary because there's earmarking rules or because there are disclosure rules. And we're just going one by one. And so I think that you saw Justice Jackson, Justice Kavanaugh, and some of the other justices were really focused on what are the implications of this case? Is it really as narrow as it seems? Is it just a matter of applying McCutcheon? Or I think at various points, the petitioner's counsel was asked point blank, are you going to be back here in 5 years saying that, you know, today you're saying earmarking means that, you know, the earmarking rules, keep everything, make it so this is unnecessary. Are you going to be back here in 5 years challenging the earmarking rules? The earmarking rules, I should explain, are if you donate to a party, and you explicitly or implicitly tell the party, I want you to spend this to support a particular candidate, that counts as a contribution. And so you would hit the contribution limit if you tried to give a party $50,000, $44,000, the max, and earmark it, you couldn't do that. That's illegal. That's a crime. And so so the argument is that earmarking makes it so that you don't need coordination limits because you can't have these elaborate circumvention because earmarking is gonna is enough of a deterrent. So the petitioner's counsel, that's okay, fine, but are you going to come and tell us that earmarking is unconstitutional in 5 years? And you're just chipping away at the foundation here. And so there was a lot of discussion in the argument about the limits of what the petitioner's argument is. I think the petitioner was very sort of good at, you know, not committing to not challenging other things, but you know, making it very clear that it's, you know, this statute here stands or falls today as it is, and it's a totally different question if you come back and challenge a different kind of law. One of the reasons that I think that this case probably the court comes down really narrowly is the second theme of the argument that I kind of focused on, which is there was a lot of discussion about political parties and how they are unique, what their role is in the political system, and whether any of that matters for the First Amendment. So Justice Kavanaugh asked a lot of questions about this. And this is kind of an interesting problem that I think cuts in a lot of different ways. So one of the things that the petitioners have said throughout this case is that these coordination limits are really harmful to political parties, obviously, because it prevents them from doing what their sort of core mission is, which is supporting their candidates. And the effect of that is that other groups, outside groups, have gained a lot more influence in our political system than the parties, because outside groups can take very, very large donations, unlimited donations, and they and spend those in elections, whereas political parties have caps on their contributions and limits on how much they coordinate. And so their ability to support their candidates and has diminished quite a bit. And then there are arguments about why that might be a bad thing. Political parties are kind of thought to be a moderating force. And so perhaps if political parties have lost power because of this and because of the rise of outside groups, that contributes to polarization and those kinds of things. And those, aren't really, First Amendment questions. I think at one point, Justice Kagan made a comment in the argument about how there's a lot of back and forth about are these limits good? Are they bad? But that's not really a question for the court. The court's question is more focused on, do these limits prevent quid pro quo corruption? And obviously, political parties are really unique in that respect, because, again, political parties are they're not like an outside group in the sense that the reason a political party exists is to support their candidates. They're not going to be viewed as a corrupting influence. And so they're very unique from the standpoint of comparing them to outside groups. And whether or not there's, several questions from the justices about why would your rationale here be limited to political parties. So, for example, if you're saying that this conduit theory of corruption, where a donor gives money to a party and then that party uses it to support the candidate as part of a quid pro quo arrangement, that's unlikely and there's no evidence that that happens. Well, why isn't that also true of another outside group? The petitioner's the response to that is that unlike a political party, an outside group, an advocacy organization or some other group, that group might itself want to corrupt the candidate. So I think that the petitioner's counsel used an example of maybe a labor union where the labor union itself might want to make a big donation to a candidate in exchange for a quid pro quo, whereas a party is not doing that. There's no really corruption from the party trying to support its own candidates. Again, that's why the party exists. And so it's not with outside groups. Yeah, sure, you might have an individual who wants to use a group to funnel an illegal donation to the candidate. The petitioner's argument is that's really unlikely. There's no evidence that that happens. But what is maybe less unlikely and what makes parties unique is that advocacy group itself, when it's in control of its own money, might try to extract a quid pro quo through some sort of large coordinated spending effort. And so that's a distinguishing feature of political parties. It's also, I think, a discussion and part of the argument about the long history of political parties in supporting their candidates. And I think historically it was pointed out that parties used to actually run the campaigns, that parties were much more the campaign apparatus than the individual or the candidate himself or herself. And so all of this discussion about what is different about political parties and the associational rights and interests that political parties and candidates have, I didn't get a sense as to how any of the justices might come out on any of these questions about why parties are unique, whether they kind of buy that, whether it matters under the First Amendment. Other than the fact that it is certainly true that under the current sort of system, parties are treated differently because they have contribution limits and then they're allowed to do coordinated spending. And so there's something kind of about that that is curious and maybe doesn't make a lot of sense. But I do think that the political party element of this is probably a way that you'll see that the court can, if it wants to, really cabin a favorable decision to not have spillover effects to other parts of the law. The third theme that I would highlight from the argument that I think is interesting, and it might be the only sort of big thing that I think that ends up really mattering in this case. And it's this question over what the evidentiary burden on the government is when it imposes restrictions and limits like this. So this question came up a lot of different ways, both from just the justices and from how the lawyers talked about it. And the reason for that is that the court's decision in McCutcheon and then the more recent decision from the court in the Cruz case, that was the Ted Cruz for Senate against the FEC from 2022. Both of those cases seemed to really scale back on judicial deference in this area and really increase the burden on what the government has to show in order to justify laws that restrict political speech in this way. And so in the Cruz case, that was a case about a different kind of contribution limit. And the court held that it was unconstitutional because the government couldn't show that it really furthered an anti-corruption interest related to quid pro quo corruption. And what the court did in Cruz is it walked through the justifications and the evidence that the government had. So the evidence, the government pointed to some congressional statements and reports. The government pointed to some media reports, maybe to even some polling data, and the Supreme Court, in a really kind of meticulous way in the Cruz case, walked through the evidence and explained how it just wasn't enough to meet the government's burden. And if you compare that to what the court did in Colorado 2, or even, quite frankly, in Buckley, it looks very different. In Colorado 2, the court kind of acknowledged that there wasn't really a lot of evidence of the specific corruption problem that they were worried about. And the court did two things. It said, well, one, it was fine to be kind of deferential to Congress's judgment, knowing that this, is a reasonable thing to worry about, this kind of anti-circumvention issue with the parties. And two, the court said is, well, this has been illegal for a long time, so it makes sense that we wouldn't have evidence that people are doing this because it's been illegal. So of course, there's not evidence. And so a big question in yesterday's argument that came up in just a lot of different ways is, what kind of evidence does the government really need? So the petitioners have pointed out in this case that the FEC had some discovery, they had an expert, and they really failed to show in the record even one case that they think, that the petitioners think, would satisfy the burden here. And they're really specific about what they think the government needs to show, which is that there is evidence that it's a real problem that people are using political parties as a conduit to circumvent the individual contribution limits as part of a quid pro quo arrangement between the donor and the candidate. And so the petitioner said, look, they say that this is a problem. There's no evidence in the record at all. Now, several of the justices, I think Justice Sotomayor, Justice Jackson, pointed out that, again, the thing that Colorado 2 said, which is, this has been illegal. Of course, there's no evidence. And the petitioner's response, and I think this is maybe for me the most important part of this case and the most important takeaway that I have, The petitioner's response is that that's really not true. So it's not true in two big ways. First, 28 states allow unlimited party coordination. And I think that, you know, 17 of those states allow unlimited party coordination while also limiting individual contributions. And so if in those, if you thought that this was going to be a problem, that when you have unlimited party coordination and individual donations, that you're going to have this kind of circumvention, you would see evidence of it in the states, and there's no evidence of it in any of these states, definitely not in the record. And if there are some cases that have been pointed out outside of the record by amici or something like that, they're definitely not at scale that this is a real problem, to show that this is a real problem. The other point that petitioners make is that federal law doesn't actually prevent coordination. It imposes limits, and those limits are, in some cases, they're variable depending on the race and where, depending on you know, what race it is and what location that you're in, and they can be as high as, you know, $4 million. And if you were really so you do have actually a lot of ability to have this kind of circumvention, even though you have these limits, and you still don't have any evidence that this is a problem under the current limits. And that also you have had with some statutory changes to the law, you've had exceptions to the limits so that now parties can spend unlimited amounts of money in coordination on things like recount litigation. And the petitioner's sort of point with all of this is, it's actually not true that this is illegal everywhere all the time. There are lots of places that this could be happening, and you still don't have any evidence for it. And this is sort of in the line of reasoning from McCutcheon, which is that you're saying that this is a problem. It seems kind of implausible, and you don't have any evidence. And so you can't defer to Congress here because First Amendment rights are at stake if you're not coming up with any evidence. You know, I think that the reason I think that this is really important is that I don't think that at any point did either the justices, you know, who are more on the left of the court, Justice Kagan, Sotomayor and Jackson, who were really challenging this point, I never heard a response from either them or the lawyers defending this that really gives an adequate explanation as to how the court can deal with this lack of evidence. I think that the lawyers defending the law repeated at times this idea that the law makes it illegal, so of course you're not going to have any evidence, and never really confronted the fact that it's actually not illegal everywhere. And even under federal law, it's not completely illegal. And so what do you make of the fact that you don't have these anti-circumvention, you don't have these circumvention problems? And what you saw in the Cruz case is that that ended up being really fatal to the defense of the law. And if I were to sort of place a bet on this, I think that that's where the court probably ends up landing, because based off of Cruz, that this seems to be a really important point. But there was a lot of pushback on this from the justices on the left of the court, not necessarily pushback as to what the record shows or whether there is evidence, but a lot of pushback that I would characterize as relitigating Cruz and relitigating McCutcheon, in the sense that questioning whether how much evidence the government really needs. I think that Justice Kagan at times, you know, she made several statements as part of her questions that she doesn't, you know, this idea that you would use parties as a conduit and these committees are all talking to each other, this doesn't actually seem that far-fetched. It seems very plausible in, you know, when FECA was enacted in the 70s, you had evidence that the dairy industry was making a bunch of different contributions to committees in order to get a political favor from Nixon. And so there are some big maybe examples in history. It also seems plausible. And so there are a lot of questions kind of pushing back on what the government's burden is. But to me, those sorts of arguments seem to be relitigating some of the more recent decisions. And it seems unlikely that the court is going to just move away from some of the cases that it has, where it's been trending in the last few days or a few years, excuse me. So I think those are the big kind of takeaways, the big themes that I got from the argument. Are we watching this sort of like tricky bait and switch where we undermine all of campaign finance law kind of one brick at a time? How much does it matter that political parties are different? What's their role sort of in this scheme and under the First Amendment? And what exactly should the evidentiary burden on the government be over time? There were a lot of other things that came up that I think I'd like to flag a few of them that are they're interesting. Amicus counsel has really pushed on standing mootness arguments and led with that with his argument. And Justice Thomas in particular seemed really focused. I couldn't get a sense of from the questions of what Justice Thomas might be thinking other than he was focused on these issues. So just to sort of give a sense of what those look like, there is a there are two kinds of issues that are going on. The first is with Vice President Vance and his status as a candidate and whether or not he has standing or whether or not at the outset of this case or whether or not his claim is moot based off him not committing to running for office again. The amicus counsel pushed on this a lot because I didn't get a sense of where Justice Thomas landed. I think at one point with Vice President Vance, he did say that he was said something like he was comfortable with Vice President Vance and he was more focused on the committee's role in this case. Justice Roberts seemed really skeptical of this argument that because Vice President Vance hasn't announced what office or that he will run for office, that he's keeping his options open, that is enough to say that this is moot. There was kind of a discussion about how and then there was also another piece to the mootness argument with Vice President Vance, which is that the federal government, by virtue of this case, and I think an executive order that was maybe signed, has said that it thinks that this law is unconstitutional. So does Vice President Vance actually face any threat of enforcement if he were to violate it? And that the Chief Justice seemed very skeptical of that argument, that you would ever sort of advise a client that the federal government today is saying they're not going to enforce it. So you should feel comfortable violating it, that would be enough to moot a claim. The other aspect of this, the amicus counsel really focused on the committees and their place. It's an interesting statutory question because the mechanism to get to the Sixth Circuit in the en banc court is this statutory procedure that allows you to go straight to the en banc court. And it only applies to, individuals. And it says something like the National Committee. And there's a statutory question about whether the congressional committees like the NRSC fit within this statute. And if they don't, does that matter if you have Vice President Vance in this case and that you're now in front of the Supreme Court? And then also, is that if that's wrong, is that waivable? I couldn't really get a sense of where the court might be leaning on that, except that there weren't a lot of questions other than from Justice Thomas on it. So maybe a lot of the justices are satisfied that the case itself is before them, whether or not, one particular party might not have a valid claim or had jurisdiction to be there. I think that another interesting discussion we heard in the argument, I think, centers on how we should interpret some of these old First Amendment cases in light of the fact that the doctrine has changed. So one example of this is when they're talking about Colorado 2, and there was a sort of an argument discussion back and forth between the lawyers defending the law and some of the justices about why. I think it was Justice Sotomayor. It might have been Justice Jackson, about whether or not Colorado 2 based its holding on the fact that this law prevents quid pro quo corruption, or whether it based its holding maybe in part on the fact that this law prevents corruption in a broader sense of the word, like undue influence and undue access, or even because, you know, before, you know, when Colorado 2 was issued, it was the case that the government could restrict political speech like this for, you know, to prevent corruption in that broader sense, preventing things like undue influence or undue access to a politician. And since Colorado 2, the court has said very clearly that the only permissible grounds for restricting political speech and political spending is preventing quid pro quo corruption. And so how do you interpret, I think a hard issue for the court is, how do you interpret these old cases that use words like corruption, but maybe had a different meaning in a broader sense? And what do we do about that now? Does that mean that the you just throw the opinion out? Does the records that and so there was a lot of a back and forth about this, because you know, the way this comes up is that a lot of these campaign finance statutes were enacted with the thought that Congress is allowed to prevent money in having too much money in politics, or Congress is allowed to prevent undue you know, influence on politicians. And that's the reason the statute might have been enacted. And now we're trying to sort of take a statute enacted for an impermissible purpose and kind of retrofit it and say it was actually enacted just for this other purpose of preventing quid pro quo corruption. The last thing that I'll comment on is, you know, obviously a big question in this case is, what are the differences between coordination and contributions? Coordination by independent groups are treated like contributions. And the court has said that they're similar. And there were some questions about this. The Chief Justice, I think his first question was about this, that obviously some kinds of coordination we treat as contributions. So if you just allow it, isn't that just allowing unlimited contributions? The Solicitor General's office, the attorney arguing for the Department of Justice, you know, differentiated between these two things, said that they're similar in some ways. They're similar in terms of maybe the bottom line bank account for the campaign. Coordination can help pay for bills that the campaign would otherwise have to pick up. But coordination is also different in important ways. When the party pays for an ad, the party's name goes on that ad. They're adopting it as their speech. And so they're not exactly the same, which can at least open the door for some daylight between treating these two things as the same. So, you know, I think that if you're betting on this, I think you bet that the challengers win. You bet that it's probably pretty narrow. And if I were to guess, I think that it would probably come down to kind of a deficient evidentiary record for the government, which allows the court to overrule Colorado 2 or say that the standard has been strengthened since. So we can turn to some questions now.
Well, thank you so much for that summary of oral argument and sort of the procedural history of this case, which is certainly important for understanding how we got to where we got to. Yes, we can turn to questions now. As a reminder to our audience, if you've got questions, feel free to submit those via the Q&A feature. And as those start coming in, I'd love to pose one of my own to kick things off. Picking up where you left off on this issue of the types of speech, the lawyer for the interveners was making what I think is probably a fairly nuanced point about what kinds of speech campaign contributions are, or this sort of these kinds of contributions are. Could you give a little bit of nuance to the sort of pure speech side of things that he was talking about versus this sort of general approbation of a party or a candidate's point?
Yeah, so there was this discussion that came up, and I think it was confusing. Some of the justices maybe were not quite following this. I think Justice Thomas had a few like follow-up questions where he's confused by this. I think the sort of the point that was being made is that going back to Buckley and in some other cases, the Supreme Court has drawn a line between spending in support of a candidate and contributions. Both of those are speech. Both of those are protected by the First Amendment. But what the court has said is that a contribution, the value of a contribution, is expressive. It signals to the world or to someone that you support that candidate. And that expressive value doesn't necessarily change if it's 3,000 or 4,000 or 5,000, which is one of the reasons the government can restrict the contributions, because the real First Amendment value, or at least a lot of the First Amendment value, is that expressive aspect of supporting a candidate. When you compare that to spending, where someone is using their money to put out their message and to try to go to the voters and make a case, that there is more value to, there's more political speech going on there, that it's not just, you know, it's not an expressive donation. Now, I don't know if the Supreme Court I don't know how much that has weight with the current Supreme Court, that sort of dividing line. It has been sort of, you know, repeated in some cases, but I think that that is what the amicus counsel was sort of signaling, is that it came up in the argument when talking about coordination, because some kinds of what we consider coordinated spending, is the candidate incurs a bill of some kind and the party just pays for that bill. And maybe it's not an advertisement, so the party's name doesn't adopt, they don't adopt an ad as their own speech. And I think amicus counsel's point is that some of this coordination just has the speech part of it is just the expressive act of supporting their candidate. And I think the pushback is that actually there's a lot of associational speech rights at stake when you're talking about the strategizing and coordinating. It's not just this kind of token expressive kind of value.
Got it. You touched on this a little bit in your sort of second category of conversation concerning the particularized nature of political parties. There seemed to be a bit of distinction between the position of the Solicitor General's office and then the lawyer on speaking on behalf of the petitioners concerning the nature of the relationship between the political party and candidates. It was something I think Mr. Martinez called on in his, like, hey, these two premises, that they're very aligned, or that the political party is trying to represent a whole bunch of people, may or may not be in conversation. Could you lay out those theses a little bit more and touch on how they may be interacting with each other in the larger conversation?
I might need a little bit of clarification of your question, but you know, the way I understand it is that, you know, there is, it might just help if you could, I'm not quite sure what the distinction you're drawing is, and then I think I could maybe answer that a little better. Yeah.
It's possible there isn't one, but it seemed to be that the lawyer speaking on behalf of petitioners was saying that political parties were not going to be working on behalf of candidates' interests. There wasn't going to be this sort of necessarily we are doing this.
Yes.
Whereas the Solicitor General's office contended that they were so parallel, there wasn't going to be any conflict of interest necessarily. Those might not be in sort of disagreement, but the amicus lawyers certainly seemed to argue that there was a tension between those two positions.
Yeah. This is a great point. And here's how I think where the disagreement is and where it really matters on this First Amendment issue. The argument that this case is like McCutcheon is that McCutcheon has this part where it talks about how once you give a contribution to someone else and they control it, then you have really cut off the chain that makes a plausible quid pro quo possible, because you want something from the candidate, but the candidate does not control that money. And the people who support this law say that's a fiction. The candidate's going to get that money because the party's going to use it to support them. The petitioner's point, and I think this point that's made, that parties don't actually operate that way. So party's goal is to support its candidates, but what the party really wants is to win elections. And so what you see, and there's some empirical evidence to support that this happens. What you see is that parties spend their money where they think that their money is going to be the most effective. And so even if they get a lot of donations through joint fundraising events with candidates, that does not mean that money goes to that candidate. Their interest is in having the largest majority that they can gain, winning the most seats that they can. So they will cut ties with a candidate that they think they're not going to waste money. If they think the candidate can't win, they will spend money on races they think that they can win, or where their money will be the most effective. And so in that way, the parties and the candidates' interests are really disaligned. Now, so the worry that you're going to have this circumvention by giving money to the party, to the candidate, doesn't pan out, because the party is not going to just answer to the candidate in that way. So that's part of that argument. Now, the reason coordination helps is if the party is going to spend money to support a particular candidate, you know, they're going to be aligned and they're going to want to know what that candidate thinks is going to help them, because that candidate probably has a lot more insight than the party is to their own particular race. But that the candidate is not going to have the argument, at least from the petitioners, the candidate is not going to have that kind of control over the party because their interests are not always aligned. That's one of the reasons that you see this argument that parties are moderating forces on our politics, because parties are more likely to support the more moderate candidate because it's the more winnable candidate, you know, the candidate has the better shot at winning. And so party and candidate interests aren't always aligned. The counterpoint to that is that, parties' interests are going to be aligned with when a candidate's helping them raise money, they want the candidate to help them raise that money. So they're going to use that money to help the candidate, and that kind of cycle.
Got it. Thanks so much. Turning from sort of what was an oral argument to sort of what wasn't, were there any arguments you were surprised not to see raise their heads? And to what degree does the fact that we didn't get any questions from Justice Gorsuch play into the way you're thinking about this case?
Yeah, so that's interesting. The question about, you know, some people noticed that Justice Gorsuch didn't ask any questions. I think Justice Barrett only asked one question. I don't know what to make of his silence. Who knows? But one of the things it did make me think about is that in the Sixth Circuit, you had two concurring opinions, one by Judge Thapar and one by Judge Bush. And both of those opinions made this point that we really act, you know, we have all of these tiers of scrutiny and narrative, like all this stuff that we do with the First Amendment, and we should actually go to something that looks more like Bruin, an originalist approach to the First Amendment. And Judge Bush wrote a long opinion about how this would come out under sort of that originalist thinking. And, you know, Justice Gorsuch is an originalist. He's a formalist. And, you know, this area of the law is really not originalist in any way. It is, as we've talked about, it's really driven by precedent and principles that are not necessary. You know, they might be right if you went and did an originalist analysis, maybe you come out the same way, but nothing about these cases is originalist in any sense. It's interesting that, you know, there are obviously a lot of amici briefs who sort of have urged this too, but you have these lower court opinions and the parties have not brought any of this up. You know, the petitioners are not making this point in their brief. So maybe it makes sense that it wouldn't come up at argument, but it didn't come up at all. You didn't see either Justice Thomas or Justice Gorsuch, who are really these, originalism over precedent kind of justices. None of them are thinking about whether this whole, or at the argument, this whole thing should be thrown out and we should do something like Bruin. This looks like a case that they're just going to keep going, you know, and following the precedent and where it's at.
Got it. Thanks so much. Turning from sort of oral argument to the potential ramifications of this case, you've staked your claim as sort of like what might be the outcome here. I'd love to touch on a couple of the questions that you've flagged where, hey, we're not quite sure where these are going to stand out. And then also the potential ramifications of a decision that rules this unconstitutional. But starting with, it was interesting to see the number of times the potential advantage or disadvantage to the parties was raised as a consideration by a variety of justices. To what degree could that conversation play into the overall decisions and opinions that we get on this?
I think that it is unlikely that I think that we would see a majority opinion that leans into the disadvantages of the party in the sense of them becoming less important players in the electoral scheme. I think that is really hard to reconcile with some sort of first principle in the First Amendment as to why we should care how influential parties are. But to the extent that there are unique associational concerns with parties and candidates, and that by disrupting sort of this internal strategizing, we have actually allowed the government to decide like how candidates should be selected, how all these campaigns should work. I mean, because you could think of a system, and right, like we used to have, where the parties are actually running these campaigns, and now the system has put its thumb on the scale of making candidates independent from their parties. I do think that there, you know, that element could inform how the court writes its opinion, as a parties are unique kind of in that way, as a way to sort of cabin the effects of this decision, if that's what the court wants to do.
Got it. Well, taking your thesis that the court seems like it may call these limits unconstitutional, what would be the ramifications of such a decision?
I think that practically speaking, you'll have, you know, parties will get a lot more involved in their federal elections in terms of being able to spend money and coordinate, you know, and that. I won't pretend to know how that would affect the actual politics of it all. I think that it's very likely that the court, or I mean, I don't know about very likely. I don't think the argument necessarily tells me it's very likely. But if I'm watching sort of the trend lines from these cases, I would guess that this is another case that really emphasizes how we have multiple layers of restrictions in the campaign finance world that all are, you know, supposedly doing the same thing. They're all trying to prevent quid pro quo corruption. So you have contribution limits, you have earmarking rules, you have disclosure rules, you have all of these different things. And the court seems to be slowly saying some of that is enough. And if you want more than that, you need to come to us with a lot of evidence that this is something that you absolutely need. And that, I think, will continue to have ramifications. I do think that it's likely that if you get an opinion like Cruz that says something like that, that you will have more challenges to more restrictions that are these prophylactic upon prophylactic restrictions, these layers of restrictions that the outer layers are going to continue to fall away if that's what we get from the court.
Got it. And I'll oppose briefly the contrapositive. What happens if this is upheld as constitutional, or we get a decision that says it just isn't standing / it's moot?
If it's standing / moot, I think that I don't know if you're the NRSC or you try to go find another candidate in another circuit to try to do it again. If it's upheld, I think a lot of it, I guess, would depend on why it was upheld. I think it would be kind of a shockwave a bit in terms of really disrupting the way in which campaign finance regulations in the First Amendment have been viewed by the court. I think, you know, so for people who are very pro campaign finance regulation, I used to be like, it wouldn't just be a victory for them. This would be like a huge breath of fresh air, because This case, if you just follow what the court's doing, this case looks like it's dead to rights. And so I think that the court would have to really break with what it has been doing in order to uphold this law. And I don't know what the ramifications are for that, except that you certainly would see probably a lot less aggressive challenges to these kinds of laws below.
Got it. We're almost at the top of the hour. So final comments or thoughts?
No, I mean, I think it was, it was, you know, for a campaign finance law that many people have never heard of and never thought about, because it's obscure. It only affects political parties. The argument was really interesting when it went really long. It seems that the court is very aware and the parties are very aware that this obscure kind of case could have pretty big ramifications on the law. And so it'll be interesting to see what the court does.
Sounds good. Well, thank you so much for taking this section of your day and sharing your expertise and insight. Really appreciate you joining us to break down the case and sum up where we may be going. Thanks also to our audience for joining and participating. Welcome listener feedback by email at fedsocforums@fedsoc.org. And as always, keep an eye on our website and your emails for announcements about other upcoming virtual events. With that, thank you all for joining us today. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the practice groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.